Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the explosive expose by veteran investigative journalist Seymour Hersh that challenges the official White House story of the SEALs raid into Pakistan that killed Osama bin Laden. Veteran CIA operations officer Robert Baer joins us to discuss the new information that Seymour Hersh has revealed in his article at the London Review of Books, The Killing of Osama bin Laden, and we will replay some of an interview I did shortly after President Obama's announcement that bin Laden was dead on May the 2nd, 2011, with a very skeptical Robert Baer, who outlines a scenario almost identical to the one that Seymour Hersh just published. Then we'll look further into the possibility that Pakistan's military intelligence service, the ISI, was sheltering bin Laden and that someone on the inside walked into the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad with the embarrassing truth to claim the $25 million reward. Shuja Nawaz, a senior scholar at the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council and author of Crossed Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within, joins us to discuss what he finds credible about the new information about the killing of bin Laden and what he doesn't. Then finally, we will examine the conditional approval the White House has given to Shell Oil to drill for oil in the Arctic waters off Alaska this summer. Lois Epstein, the Arctic Program Director for the Wilderness Society, who serves on the Ocean Energy Safety Advisory Committee for the Department of Interior's Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement, joins us to discuss her concerns and her article at Alaska Dispatch News, Shell Hasn't Earned Enough Trust to Drill in Alaska's Arctic Seas. And joining us now is Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil, the basis of the movie Syriana, which earned George Clooney an Oscar for his portrayal of Baer. He is considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. His latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Good to be back.
And this bombshell that Seymour Hersh has dropped in the pages of the London Review of Books, the killing of Osama bin Laden, is creating quite a stir. The White House, of course, has refuted it. Peter Bergen, the CNN terrorism correspondent, has refuted it. But what's your opinion?
Well, there's a couple points that have always bothered me about that raid. And first of all, I've worked with the SEALs. I've worked with Delta Force. They never go in light like this into a raid. Two helicopters across enemy territory into an enemy garrison. They had absolutely, according to the official narrative, no way to take out the garrison there, the police, fire department, and so on. It all just sort of wrong to me, and what sounded wrong to me about the official narrative is that they went on this raid based on analysis that there was, you know, following the couriers, looking at overhead, you know, a 50-50 chance bin Laden was there. I mean, I spent enough time in the White House. No, they don't do 50-50 chances before an election. Never, ever do they do that. They need 100% certainty. So when you take that basis, as the SEALs couldn't have gone in there with just 24 guys alone on a raid. There are no ninja raids in special forces. I went back and I said, what did happen? And early on, I assumed there was a walk-in that somehow proof was obtained that bin Laden was there, either from photography, voice, or whatever. What exactly happened in that compound that night, we're going to have to wait to see. But the official narrative, a shootout, completely unilateral SEALs raid, just didn't make sense. It never did.
Well, I think what we should do now is play an interview that I did with you on May the 2nd of 2011, shortly after President Obama announced the death of bin Laden at the White House and first details of the raid came out, because essentially, what you and I discussed back then, just very shortly after the raid, is pretty much chapter and verse what Seymour Hersh has written in his article. So let's go to that clip of Background Briefing from May the 2nd, 2011. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks. Now, today there's been some interesting announcements on Pakistan's media. Popular news anchors, many of them tied to these ISI spy agency, referred to the late Osama bin Laden as Shaheed or martyr. Does that surprise you?
Oh, not at all. I mean, I think, Ian, we almost have to assume that the Pakistanis were protecting him. He was living in a military cantonment area in between three regiments. His front gate abutted a military academy. This is an area that ISI is all over, as is military intelligence. And the chances of a foreigner living in a compound of that size with all that security not coming to their attention, I think, is pretty well zero. You know, who protected him or why? I don't know. I don't know if we'll ever get the answers. Was it the leadership? Was it, a general in that area? I just simply can't tell you. Was it sheer luck? It could have been, but it's like a black swan in this case. So, you know, he's a popular guy in Pakistan. He's forgotten. They've forgotten about 9/11, and he's looked at as an Islamic hero that's going to hold back the forces of the infidels, and that's as far as it gets. And the fact that he had struck the United States, the country deeply unpopular in Pakistan, made him popular.
So does that mean, though, that the government and the security agencies had a strong reason for staying silent and letting Washington take the credit for this raid because they didn't want to deal with the public backlash?
Well, you know, here is a question of the dog that didn't bark. I mean, normally, if you send in 5-6 helicopters or however many there were into your country, raid a house without telling anybody, you raise your voice. You close the American embassy. You declare somebody persona non grata. You just don't let it pass. I think what happened is the Pakistanis allowed this raid. They got caught protecting bin Laden, or somebody got caught. And they said, all right, come on in, take down the compound, and get out. Don't attach our name to this at all, and we'll just be quiet. This was a finesse that was never going to work. I mean, you get anybody on this radio station who's spent time in the Special Forces, and they'll tell you, you never send 24 SEALs into a hostile area surrounded by military power, you know, and surrounded by units always on full alert. It's on the Indian border, and take your chances. They'll get in and get out. I don't know if you've ever flown on a Black Hawk helicopter, but they are slow, slow, slow. You can see them for hours coming across the Afghan border. You paint them with radar. You could follow them the whole way. I mean, let's forget the Hollywood stuff of sneaking in there like ninjas. You know, Sylvester Stallone was not on those helicopters. This was a well-planned operation, and they didn't take risks. This president, if he did take the risk of sending them in unannounced, he's got more guts or more foolishness than I ever suspected. This was too well done.
So this, obviously, I only played about 4 minutes of the interview. It went on for about 18 minutes. And one of the things that, of course, looms now that if the Seymour Hersh article pans out is real questions about, obviously, there's been questions about the ISI for the longest time, but if they had been sheltering bin Laden all along, and Seymour Hersh indicates that they may have been doing it at the behest of the Saudis, it's difficult not to jump the conclusion that maybe ISI had some foreknowledge of 9/11 if bin Laden was their asset all along.
It certainly makes you wonder. It makes you wonder why they assassinated bin Laden. Why didn't they simply grab him? He was unarmed, 24 SEALs. They could have flex cuffed him, had him out there, had him on a helicopter, been out of there in 5 minutes, and sat him down, however long it would take, to start who was behind 9/11. But clearly, with the number of rounds fired, the fact we never saw the body, is the intent of that mission was to assassinate him. So what did he have to say? Who was he going to finger that made so many people so nervous? But Abbottabad, I'll say it again, you cannot hide a foreigner in Abbottabad for any length of time without coming to the attention the Intelligence Bureau, first of all, which is Pakistani intelligence, and then ISI. And let's don't forget that ISI is not a rogue element in the Pakistani government. Everything, these officers are all in rotation. Everything it does, it goes up to the prime minister and the president and the army command. So if, in fact, bin Laden was a prisoner there in Abbottabad, he was a prisoner of the Pakistani government, not ISI. It's not a rogue organization. I don't care what people say. And so they knew he was there, certainly. You know, can you go out 7 years and hide in Abbottabad and not know? I think anybody who's lived in Pakistan will tell you that every day there's sort of a knock on the door. It's the police. They talk to the chowkidar about the foreigners. What are they doing? You know, and the rest of it. You simply don't set up a compound as you would in, I don't know, the desert, Nevada, and not have people notice. Impossible. Totally impossible. So we've established, I think, certainly with or without Hirsch's article, that he was a prisoner or known to be there by the Pakistani government. And what was their real motivations? And, you know, it does make you wonder. And there's a close relationship between Saudi Arabia intelligence, and the Pakistanis. Saudi Arabia pays for their intelligence service in many ways. They funded the war in Iraq. I even knew the guy that was bin Laden's case officer. He was part of the royal family. They know exactly what bin Laden was doing when he was there. And, you know, why was there such a hurry to kill him rather than to capture him? And what was he doing in Pakistan proper? All these questions we're not getting answers to, just as we haven't gotten the answers. How did those 15 Saudis end up on those airplanes? Who recruited them? Who paid for them? How did the mechanisms happen? And there's this amnesia in this country. It's like, well, it's ancient history. But it's not ancient history. I mean, this keeps on coming around and around. Who are our allies, and what are they up to? And the question is, we don't know. And we have a tame media that doesn't ask these questions and doesn't pursue it.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of 4 New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil, the basis of the movie Syriana, which earned George Clooney an Oscar for his portrayal of Baer. He's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. So given the suspicions that have arisen as a result of, well, going back to the very beginning on May the 2nd of 2011, in the interview that we just played that I did with you back then, it's pretty clear that you didn't buy the official line from the beginning. But it does sort of, you mentioned in that piece that you thought, you know, that somebody from ISI probably broke ranks and told the Americans that he was there. That seems to be the case, right? There was this walk-in that went into the U.S. Embassy, and I think he got $20 million of the $25 million reward money.
$25 million, according to the article. I don't know about that, but yeah. Or who he is. I don't have his name, but I've heard about this walk-in from other people besides Hirsch, and that he's been relocated in the United States. But that's about what I know. The thing is, it's the context that really bothers me. I worked with Delta Force, and we were going to go into Iraq in the mid-90s, and the CIA wanted to go in with two helicopters, civilian helicopters, and Delta turns around, says, no, we want this mission, and we're going to go in with 500 troops and complete air supremacy. And I you know, there's a bunch of other operations I did with them. And so when I look at this, going in with the two helicopters, I just immediately reject it. That's not the way Tier 1 operatives go on a mission like this.
So if this is the way that Seymour Hersh has reported and the way that you suspected it really happened from the beginning, it's coming out at a very odd time when the White House is hosting a meeting at Camp David of all of the Sunni Arab monarchs in the Gulf, and the Saudis have sent the son of the new king, who apparently is pretty much running the country, along with the crown prince. And there's a lot of reporting now that...
Ian, let me interrupt you. We don't know squat about Saudi Arabia. You know, the president on Friday says the king's coming, and then he gets blindsided on Monday. I mean, we don't know what drives that country. We don't know who's in charge, whether it's a 29-year-old son, the Minister of Defense, or his uncle, Nayef. We just don't know. I mean, we still don't know. Again, I'm going back to 9/11. what the connection was between bin Laden and the royal family. You hear all these crazy rumors out there, and they may be crazy, but on the other hand, I can't tell you what the facts are, and neither can the United States government.
So in terms of the criticism that Seymour Hersh is getting from Peter Bergen, for example, at CNN, first of all, the criticism is that the walk-in into the embassy would have been detected because the ISI watches the U.S. embassy in Islamabad. Presumably, if he was an ISI guy, I think he would have arranged a more subtle walk-in.
To get into the embassy, it's easy to do for a walk-in. So you board a bus outside the diplomatic compound with about 50 other people. It takes you to the American Embassy consulate. You climb off the bus and you pretend to be applying for a visa and then pull aside an intelligence officer and say, I have something to say. And it's amazing how these work. I mean, they have, you can do it. So that's not a reason why the story couldn't be true.
And the other criticism is that Durrani, the former ISI head that Seymour Hersh checked the story with, was only there in the 90s, and therefore his information was pretty cold.
I don't know. All these Pakistan intelligence officers, they live in military compounds. They gossip. It just, I can't talk about Hersh's sources because I don't know how good they are. I can just raise my doubts about the official narrative. And as we know, it changed over a course of 2 days that he dressed as a woman, bin Laden, that there was a firefight, that he had a gun. No, he didn't have a gun. Clearly, in the early days, they didn't know what to say because that helicopter crashed, which it shouldn't have. I find the Hersh story fascinating, and I simply can't comment on any more detail or who his sources are, and that's sort of key. When something like this comes out, the way I would play it was make sure that other parts of the media have the same story, and they come out simultaneously. He knew the firefight he was going to walk into when he put the story out, simply because the mainstream media has the White House narrative, and that's the one they just like Zero Dark 30.
Right. In other words, people who've invested in the fiction have to defend the fiction because their reputations are at stake.
Yeah, let me say this again. No president takes action based on analysis or looking at metadata or using confessions extracted by torture. They just don't. They don't. They need hard facts before putting U.S. troops on the ground outside of a war zone. They simply, since Desert One, when those helicopters went down the desert and ran, the rules changed. Have to have eyes on the target, 100% certainty of your intelligence, and 100% certainty you won't be interfered by local forces. Now, that could mean, having armed drones up, F-16s in the air, it doesn't matter. SEALs will not send somebody into a foreign country without complete air supremacy and complete supremacy on the ground. Now, how they achieve that in Abbottabad, I would think people who could really do that are the Pakistanis. But there are no ninjas. I mean, the SEALs are very brave and they do a wonderful job. And there's a lot of them been killed in combat, but they know how to stay alive as well.
So what then do you make of the main criticism that Hersh is getting is from the idea that he's used these unnamed sources. Now, in defending himself on CNN, Seymour Hersh said that one of the main sources, it was very high up in the CIA, and there are people that are still inside the government that are, he said, they're very brave and they're giving him information as well. What would the motives be of officers inside, either inside or outside of the government, refuting the official story and effectively embarrassing the President of the United States?
Oh, there's a lot of reasons. There's in the intelligence community, there's a deep-seated dislike of Obama, the Democrats. There is a whole bunch of people in the intelligence community that don't like the idea that torture was used and this contention that torture was used to find bin Laden. Would have an axe to grind, just pure narcissism on the part of people inside the intelligence community. Oh, I know this, I know that, and you don't know it. That sort of attitude. It could be any number of things. But, you know, anonymous sources, with a story like this, that's the weakness of a story like this. And this is why he's going to, you know, do some hard time in the media, Hirsch. On the other hand, you have, you know, Watergate, Deep Throat, was done with anonymous sources. So it can be done, but you're a lot better off when you got mainstream media reporting the same thing. When you're an outlier with a story like this, that's a tough one.
So what would your, just in closing then, what would your prediction be that it would, that this will die because the mainstream media won't pick it up? The White House have already refuted it. As I say, Peter Bergen has it at CNN, has done his best to refute it. Do you think that's what happened, that he'll be marginalized because the mainstream press don't want to take up a story that sort of indicates that they swallowed the official line, hook, line, and sinker?
I think unless the Washington Post and the New York Times put out with a story supporting it, he'll be marginalized.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us today, Robert Baer.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil, the basis for the acclaimed movie Syriana, which earned George Clooney an Oscar for his portrayal of Robert Baer. He is considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. And joining us now is Shuja Nawaz, who is the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army and the Wars Within. Shuja Nawaz is a native of Pakistan who has worked as a journalist, a television producer and a political and strategic analyst. He's also worked for the World Health Organization and was a director at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna and is now a senior scholar at the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council of the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Shuja Nawaz.
Thank you, Ian.
And just to follow on from Robert Baer's pessimism about the mainstream press picking up this story and buttressing in any way what Seymour Hersh has reported, now we learn that NBC News they know that the year before the U.S. raid that killed Osama bin Laden, that a walk-in asset from Pakistani intelligence told the CIA where the world's most wanted man was hiding, and that these two sources, plus a third intelligence source, say that the Pakistani government knew where bin Laden was hiding all along. So to some extent, at least NBC News is buttressing not all of Seymour Hersh's story, but some of it.
Well, I think that is likely to happen. And what Robert Baer was speaking about was the need to triangulate information from different sources, as well as for the mainstream media in the United States in particular, to pick different bits of the story to see if they can corroborate it. And I think that may happen. Cy Hersh is a very fine reporter, but clearly he didn't have enough sources on the ground to confirm this in Pakistan, for instance, not enough contemporary sources. So he's relying very heavily on anonymous sources in the United States. And interestingly, and this may be something that he did on the basis of legal advice, the fact that he published this article outside the United States takes him outside the ambit of any legal proceedings for mentioning the names of CIA station chiefs that he mentions in the article as having been outed by the ISI. So the story has a number of contradictions that are very difficult to explain, and I think Mr. Hirsch has not adequately explained them. Let me list just a few. In the period before and after the raid, Pakistan reportedly on official action or with support from the ISI actually managed to out three station chiefs of the CIA. Their names were published in the media outside the United States, but not in the United States. That is not evidence of an organization that is working hand in glove with the CIA. Secondly, he speaks without checking adequately of the danger of crossing into Pakistan and therefore the need for the Pakistanis to stand down their radar and their patrolling aircraft. In fact, Pakistan does not have radar facing Afghanistan. Its radar arrays are aligned to the east towards India. The only radar installations it has are legacy instruments that were employed during the Soviet occupation, and a lot of those were actually ground radar, which was looking at crossings at ground level. And most of those are probably dead or out of date by now. There is no active air patrol off the Afghan-Pakistan border because they don't expect an air attack from Afghanistan. It's the ground forces that they're worried about and the infiltration. The other point, I think, which is worth mentioning is that the story of the walk-in is probably the most credible. But again, one needs perhaps a little more corroboration of this. I don't think General Durrani would be the best source for that because he is, in fact, way out of date. When he was DG ISI in the late 1980s, early 90s, the people that are now there were probably just joining the Pakistan military, and a few of them were very junior officers. So he has no relationships to build on or to rely on for his information, despite the fact, as Robert Baer says, that he lives in a military cantonment area. So there are gaps, but I think it's now a question of unraveling the web that had been created of secrecy around the actions leading to the raid on Abbottabad.
Well, NBC News is saying that they've been pursuing leads about this walk-in and about what Pakistan intelligence knew. But part of the Seymour Hirsch story that people are skeptical about is that once the walk-in gave the U.S. information and then they in turn told the Pakistani government that they knew that they had bin Laden, that a deal was struck that included allowing the U.S. to set up detailed surveillance of the area, obtaining DNA evidence, confirming bin Laden's identity, and even providing a Pakistani agent to help guide the operation in exchange for continued U.S. financial support for, I take it, for the ISI and for the other national intelligence services and its leaders. So what do you think of that charge?
I think that's a bit of a stretch because I've been following U.S.-Pakistan relations very closely in these years. And for the U.S. to accede to such a request would be very difficult. It is not just the CIA that determines what aid Pakistan gets. You have the Hill getting involved. And as Senator McCain emphatically said today, that he has had no briefing from anyone on the record or behind the scenes, which would indicate that this was the case, that they were doing something in order to win favor from Pakistan. If you recall also, there was a report by Karen DeYoung of the Washington Post fairly soon after the Abbottabad raid in which she was given information that the CIA had analyzed the conversations between U.S. leaders and General Kiani, the army chief, and General Pasha, the head of the ISI, and their voice analysis indicated that they were truly surprised that the raid had taken place. I'm willing to believe that if there is a walk-in, and there does seem to be strong evidence of that, and I have my own leads that I have not been able to completely track down the individual, but that with such information, the Pakistanis were certainly not kept aware of the actual plans for an attack on Abbottabad. That was something that the U.S. would have done on its own.
So the unilateral nature of the action then, you think it pretty much holds up? And that, of course, is the position that the White House is, and the Pentagon also weighed in today on that as well.
Yes, I think that does hold up, and that also helps explain why, after the raid, yet another CIA station chief found his name being bandied about the Pakistani media and in a court case and had to leave the country.
Again, I'm speaking with Shuja Nawaz, who's the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army and the Wars Within. He's a native of Pakistan who has worked as a journalist, a television producer, and a political and strategic analyst. And he's also worked for the World Health Organization and was a director at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna and is now a senior scholar at the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council of the United States. So you know the former head of the ISI, the director general of the ISI, General Ahmad Shuja Pasha. Do you think you could ever get to him and have him answer some of these questions, given that Durrani's information was stale, but surely Pasha's information would be golden?
Pasha's information would be contemporary and most accurate from his point of view, considering that this report essentially points the finger at him and his army chief as being complicit, something that both of them denied, particularly when General Pasha presented himself before Pakistan's parliament to say that maybe there had been failings in the intelligence system, that they had failed to detect the U.S. attack, but that they were certainly not complicit in it. He was very emphatic, and if this report were to stand or be corroborated by additional independence evidence from other sources, that his name would be mud in Pakistan, and as would be that of General Kiani, his army chief.
So, in other words, he's living in the Gulf, and he'd be become person non grata, right? I mean,
it would be very difficult for him to operate even in the Gulf if it became known that that he had given up on Pakistan's sovereignty. I've known General Pasha since he was the Director General Military Operations, fighting the Pakistani Taliban, masterminding the whole effort against them. He is a very strong nationalist, and I would doubt very much that he would do anything that, in his mind, was selling out the sovereignty of his own country.
But to the point that that NBC News has buttressed, and that is that a year before the U.S. raid that killed bin Laden, a walk-in asset from Pakistani intelligence told the CIA where bin Laden was hiding. And that apparently Mark Morrell, the former deputy director of the CIA, his new book is saying they also had suspicions that the Pakistanis knew that bin Laden was there and were hiding him. So how can you explain that part of the story?
I think the suspicions have always been there, and I don't doubt that those suspicions will continue to exist till we get further corroboration. That seems to be the most credible part of this story. And as Robert Baer was saying, actually, it's much easier for somebody within the ISI hierarchy at a particular level to be able to go in under normal exchanges with counterparts in the U.S. embassy and use that opportunity to slip away and talk about this particular nugget of information. You don't even have to pretend to be an applicant for a visa. So I would expect that if the person was in one of the compartments within the ISI that either had become aware or was responsible for somehow keeping tabs on bin Laden, that that infiltration into the U.S. embassy would have been quite easy and perfectly practicable.
But it does raise very serious questions, which Robert Baer raised, and that is if Pakistani intelligence, if bin Laden was an asset of Pakistani intelligence, we don't know how long that relationship has existed. And if it does go back to before 9/11, it raises suspicions about prior knowledge of 9/11.
Well, the cynics would say that this was the golden goose. If they gave up bin Laden, there would be really no need for the U.S. to pursue a lot of this relationship with Pakistan. That, you know, they would want to get out of the region in a hurry. It would be mission accomplished. That didn't happen. I don't think that if the Pakistanis were aware that they would have handed him over, if this is really where an area that Robert Baer knows more about than I do, which is the Saudi connection, comes into play. We don't know to what extent the Saudis were kept aware of this or how it would complicate the Pakistani intelligence collaboration with the Saudis vis-a-vis bin Laden.
But what is pretty clear is that the United States didn't want to take him alive and they didn't want to debrief him. And surely he's somebody that could have, he would be a treasure trove of information, wouldn't he? It's pretty clear from even what President Obama revealed and what was revealed later in terms of the official story that he was killed by the SEALs. That seemed to be their intent. Is that the way you see it?
I think the evidence points towards that. He was not heavily guarded. He, according to most reports that have emerged, the bits and pieces that have emerged, there is every indication that there was not going to be a firefight. In fact, despite some of the early reporting of a firefight, there was none. Very few shots were fired. There was one report, I recall, based on a Pakistani leak of interrogation of his wife, that when the helicopters were heard, he was heard to say, the Americans are here. So clearly he was expecting something also, but all this is uncorroborated.
But it does raise the question that you know, if this is an odd situation where the suspicion is that the Saudis and the Pakistanis wanted bin Laden dead, but it was actually the Americans who killed him, and it does seem like that was their intention.
That's the way it appears. Yes.
Yeah. So that I can't answer my own question. I don't know whether you can.
I can't. I'm afraid without further information coming from particularly local sources and others within the U.S. establishment, it's going to be hard to triangulate this information. I think what Cy Hirsch has done is quite a clever piece of sleuthing, connecting some of the dots and then by assumption connecting other dots, but not with strong evidence to support those connections.
So what do you think is going to happen in the next few days? If this has got some life, and if NBC is corroborating some of the story, and it may end up at the end of the day that the White House still can maintain the basic contours of its story, that if it proves to be a unilateral action, and you suggested that that's not such a stretch, that in the sense that there wasn't any radar looking in the direction from which they came, which was Afghanistan. But there's still other questions about the certainty, which Bob Baer said, you know, a president's not going to order a raid unless he has 100% certainty just before an election. I mean, that all presidents surely remember what happened to Jimmy Carter in Iran.
Yes, we all do. And the president certainly must have been fully briefed on that. But I do have an explanation for how Pakistan may have collaborated without being witting accomplices in this, which is the implication of this article. If you were to ask the Pakistanis for permission for some U.S. military exercise for helicopters to land at the Tarbela Ghazi airport, which was a special services group commando base, that would be granted. So they would be expecting flights from Bagram or from Jalalabad to come in that direction. And if you look at the map, it's just a very short hop from there to Abbottabad. So that's really one very good explanation for how there may have been cooperation from the Pakistan side without witting participation in a plan to capture or kill bin Laden. That is on the assumption that the Americans didn't tell them exactly where he was based on the walk-in information.
And indeed, that makes sense, because remember that the helicopter crashed going in. One of the two helicopters crashed, and a third was brought in to take them out,
yes.
Wasn't it? And yes. Where was it standing by? It wouldn't have been loitering, would it? So
all reports are that it was landing and taking off from the base at Tarbela, the Ghazi base, which was where the special services group, the Pakistani commandos, had their base.
And they have a fairly close working relationship with the U.S.?
Yes, that base had been used occasionally for supporting activities in the Afghan border sector.
Well, I'd like to stay in touch, particularly if you manage to get to talk to General Pasha, because obviously this is the Seymour Hersh, you know, he's come under a lot of criticism, but I think he's provided a lot of information that, as a journalist, we all should celebrate.
Well, I think it would be in General Pasha's interest also to clear this issue, particularly since this is a pretty damning article as far as he and his army chief are concerned, and I'm sure that he's carefully looking at it.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Shuja Nawaz.
Thank you as always, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Shuja Nawaz, who's the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within. He's a native of Pakistan who has worked as a journalist, a television producer, and a political and strategic analyst. He's also worked for the World Health Organization and was a director at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna, and is now a senior scholar at the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council of the United States. And welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Alaska is Lois Epstein, who is the Arctic Program Director for the Wilderness Society. She currently serves on the Ocean Energy Safety Advisory Committee for the Department of the Interior's Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement, and has testified before the House and Senate on more than a dozen occasions. She has an article at Alaska Dispatch News, Shell Hasn't Earned Enough Trust to Drill in Alaska's Arctic Seas. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lois Epstein.
Thanks very much, Ian.
And there's a conditional approval from the Obama administration for Shell to drill in the remote waters of the Chukchi Seas. That's about as remote, rough, and difficult part of the world that you could possibly want to visit, let alone do some very complicated engineering. Didn't Shell have a big, expensive rig, floating sort of circular rig that they had moved up there to the Arctic waters and then end up running aground? So give us a sense of the challenges that exist, both in terms of engineering and climate and environment, let alone the potential for accidents.
Well, that's a big question because it is, as you noted, very, very complicated to drill up there. And the mobilization, demobilization is also extremely complex. In 2012, Shell was drilling in the Chukchi Sea and the Beaufort Sea. Those are both part of the Arctic Ocean. And so the northern coast of Alaska is where they were located. And they had these enormous drill rigs that they brought up there. One was a circular rig, as you mentioned, the Kulik. And when it left Alaska in December, it entered stormy seas, and it had a single tow line. Shell made a big deal of its the tugboat, that it was specially designed. Well, that was its first major outing, and it completely failed. It lost the tow line. It ended up grounding on a remote island. It was a complete loss to the company. So drilling is hard because there are ice-filled waters. They had to move one of the drill rigs when it first started drilling and bring it back again. And the federal government did not allow them in 2012 to actually drill into oil-bearing zones because they didn't have their response equipment in good enough shape to allow it to enter those zones in case they were to have a blowout like BP had in the Gulf of Mexico in 2010. So now here we are in 2015 with essentially similar equipment, of course a replacement drill rig for the one that grounded, and all the activities going to occur in the Chukchi Sea, so you have twice as intense operations there. There are about 25 support vessels. There are going to be 40 helicopter flights, round-trip flights each week, landing on a floating operation and different support vessels. What's really important to remember is not only is this a challenging, icy, storm-filled, foggy waters, but the wildlife there has been there, you know, essentially without disturbance for millennia. We're talking bowhead whales and fish and walruses. There are some very sensitive areas near the drilling that President Obama just a couple of months ago set aside to not allow future leasing because those were so sensitive and so important to the wildlife. And then you also have on the coastline federal lands that are in the poorly named National Petroleum Reserve, but very important for migratory birds. If there's a major spill, there could be devastating consequences, and the people who live up there rely on the ocean. They rely on whaling for a good part of their culture, but also they use it to survive on food. There's not supermarkets up there to what we're used to, even here in Anchorage, but certainly your listeners in L.A. So it's a logistical nightmare in a lot of respects, and as an engineer, I'm speaking. I just can't imagine being possible to get everything right, and the consequences of anything going wrong are very serious.
Well, apparently, so far Shell has spent $6 billion on the Arctic drilling to date, and they've got little to show for it. So, I guess in for a penny, in for a pound, right?
That is somewhat true. About $2 billion was for getting the leases in 2008 with the Bush administration. So that was their first foray, and they spent a lot of money in 2012 and were not allowed to drill into the oil-bearing zone. So they don't know what is down there. So even though the price of oil is so low at this point, they're still willing to go into some of the highest cost drilling environments in some of the riskiest parts in the world. So no matter what the price of oil is, even if it goes up, this is still going to be more costly and more risky than other places.
So assuming that they can actually set up these ocean-going platforms with all the support vessels and drill for oil and find oil, I'm totally mystified as to how they get the oil out, whether they do underwater pipelines or whatever. But just to go cut to the worst case scenario, if there's an oil spill, apparently the closest Coast Guard station with equipment for responding to an oil spill is over 1,000 miles away, And this, you're talking about air everywhere. Weather is just incredibly bad. And we have major storms, icy waters, and waves up to 50 feet high. So it sounds like an accident waiting to happen.
Not to mention that most of the year, and I know this is hard to believe, I was amazed the first time I saw it, the ocean is frozen. So they're only allowed to drill when the ocean is open and the ice has melted, but that's a very short time. So you have, should you find commercially producible quantities of oil, you're going to have to get that to the shore. You can't use tankers because if you want to produce all year, you have a frozen ocean. So you have to have oil pipelines that are below the seabed because in the summer, when the ice moves, you could actually even scour the seabed and cause problems with pipelines. So they have to be buried. And then they would enter the poorly named, as I mentioned, National Petroleum Reserve, the sensitive area with caribou and migratory birds that fly all around the world. It would have to cross the National Petroleum Reserve and eventually reach the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System. And that's roughly 300-400 miles of new pipeline on land that would have to be created, you know, new steel, because this would be a big pipeline. It's a tremendous effort. And, you know, as I noted earlier, each stage has to be done near flawlessly or you have the potential for a major environmental challenge. And then, of course, you mentioned this in your opening, there's the climate change element of the offshore operations. Say they do find quite a bit of oil. Right now, they're not as invested, Shell and others, in infrastructure up there, but they find a lot. They're going to want to produce it, and then we'll be relying on using that oil so much more. So if you're going to stop, if you're going to change domestic production, this is a good place to start because right now we don't have that huge investment by anyone other than the Shell as the leaseholder and their $6 billion. Which is an enormous amount of money, but for Shell, it's not that much, believe it or not.
But just to be clear on this, let's assume they strike oil and that they put down the whatever is necessary at the wellhead, and then they have to. When you say they have to have underwater pipes, do these pipes have to be buried underneath the sea floor, or can they sit on the sea floor?
They have to be underneath in order to ensure that they are not affected by these icebergs that will scour the seafloor. And they actually rip off portions of the seafloor. So you have to have enough cover and have the pipelines buried deep enough so that they won't be affected by the icebergs.
Well, who the hell's going to do that? I mean,
they have done it for short distances in other parts of the Arctic offshore. Off of Prudhoe Bay, there are some man-made islands, and there are some short pipelines. Each generation of those pipelines gets better and better and more expensive, but that's not completely impossible to do.
But how long is that? Would that be? Do you know from where the fields are in the ocean or potential fields are to the shoreline? How many miles are we talking about?
Where they're looking right now, this summer, should everything go right and Shell does move out there and do their exploratory drilling, it's about 70 miles offshore.
Boy, the $6 billion is going to look like chump change, right?
It might. You're right. As I said, this is incredibly costly oil and gas. So they are, you know, they want to know what's out there, and should they find oil, they may not actually produce it for a very long time. It'll just be booked as reserves for Shell's accounting purposes and their investors.
So in terms of the local reaction, what is it? Because we're always told that, you know, Alaska depends on oil and everybody gets a little bit of a kickback thanks to Sarah Palin, I believe. So what's the local reaction to this? Do you have a division between environmentalists and developers?
So just a quick correction. The permanent fund dividend has existed for a number of decades. It was bumped up a little bit in the Sarah Palin years because oil prices were so high and we had extra revenue. But essentially, it depends in Alaska where you're talking about drilling. Onshore drilling is much more supported than offshore drilling, and that's particularly true when you're talking about coastal residents in northern Alaska who rely on the ocean for their way of life, their whaling festivals. It's part of their culture. It's part of what makes Alaska special. So, yes, we do get money as Alaska residents from oil development that goes through the Trans-Alaska pipeline. But as I noted, that's way down the road. In terms of federal offshore waters, the state of Alaska doesn't get any money. In the Gulf of Mexico, there is some money that goes to the state of Louisiana. But in Alaska right now, Congress has not changed anything to allow us. And they may never change it, the state of Alaska to get money. So we would get a small amount from the offshore drilling. And that's not even well known throughout the state. Everybody thinks about, we get money from Prudhoe Bay operations, which is onshore. We must get it from offshore, but that's not the case because these are federal waters.
So what's your feeling then about, because obviously the environmental community feels somewhat betrayed by the Obama administration and they're not too happy about it. What's your personal reaction?
Well, as a technical person, I think this is one of those situations where you have to say, we can't do it well, so we shouldn't do it at all. These are incredibly challenging waters to be drilling. They're also near pristine. There are not many places like that in the world. I think Americans are smarter than feeling they must utilize oil everywhere that it can be found. I think there are things that we could be doing to confront climate change more so we don't need this oil. So I think there's so many technical justifications for why it should be turned down. I even think there are financial reasons why Shell should be taking a second look about whether this is a good way to proceed. With the price of oil the way it is, and as someone who follows these markets, it's likely to stay down for quite a while. So it doesn't seem like this is a good investment for a smart oil company.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Lois Epstein.
Thank you very much, Ian. Enjoyed it.
And again, I've been speaking with Lois Epstein, who is in Anchorage, Alaska, where she's the Arctic Program Director for the Wilderness Society. She currently serves on the Ocean Energy Safety Advisory Committee for the Department of Interior's Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement and has testified before the House and Senate on more than a dozen occasions. She has an article at Alaska Dispatch News, Shell Hasn't Earned Enough Trust to Drill in Alaska's Arctic Seas. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graeme Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.